I'll give space for a moment if anybody has any questions or thoughts that have come up from today's topic that they'd like to offer.
The biggest impediment to people to be to have God with them?
What is the biggest impediment to people to having God with them? Can you elaborate on it just a little bit?
I was thinking of the scene in Jesus of Nazareth. I can't remember exactly what he said, but he alluded to God changing with the wind. And that he doesn't know. I was just wondering I guess what the most common if there was like one thing for people to hang on to or I guess what the biggest trap is that keep people separate from God.
I think the greatest battle that we are all up against is having lived our lives on the outside of so many incarnations and relating to the world from the outside in. And we all sit in this room and think, I'm Zach and you're Brian. And we create an immediate veil of separation in our oneness with God, with each other, and the ultimate truth that we aren't actually these people that we say we are. And the question is, how do we learn to relate to life from inside of ourself with God as a flowing spirit, the wind of God blowing in us, so that we can actually be guided from the inside of ourself and not the whims and fancies of a consciousness which is operating only on the outside. And we see for each person there's a very gradual progression of our consciousness moving from the outside to the inside, and it has very identifiable steps for each person in their journey. This is why at first it's so important to have a kind of communal affiliation and to find a church or a group of people with teachings that resonate, to find a purpose. All of this is on the outside, but it's our starting point to moving towards the inside. And so gradually we become better and better at finding some kind of source within us that is always there in truth. But if our consciousness is always operating from the outside in, we forget and we don't look for it. And so gradually we see that these forms that we take on, which represent a positive direction at a time, will fall away. And we learn to become centered inside of our own tree of life. But it can be a very hard thing, and it's not anything any of us can force on someone else. We have to reflect even in this life and our own life experience to where we have come from. And imagining a time when we were completely confused about the nature of God and our own purpose, and we were just looking at where can I have a happy hour tonight, or what can I eat for lunch today that's gonna be enjoyable. there was nothing on the inside that was guiding that process. It was all based on how our experience is on the outside. And so for each of us, there's a long road to travel of internalizing ourself and of relating to God from the inside out. And I think that's why I've been compelled to speak on this nature of tradition and change. Change is the spirit, and change is like the wind that blows. And tradition is the need for us to have some kind of formula to move in that direction. But ultimately, we can't compromise the spirit for that formula. And so for each person, we're all somewhere on that pendulum. We're all somewhere climbing that ladder. And I think as we mature spiritually, we're able to see very clearly where we're at and where other people are at. And it's always when we are completely self-identified on the outside that we want to crucify the spirit the most. And so that's what we saw with the hierarchy of the Pharisee, is that all they could imagine was crucifying this one who came and said God lived within him, within himself. That was the worst thing imaginable to be said, because all of their sense of security, all of their sense of self came from their pride of pedigree and what they thought they had in their tradition. But for all of us, we have that same exact journey to embark upon. So I would say it's a gradual process of our own inner unfoldment taking precedent over our outer attachments and identifications. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think of like growing up even, and how I was raised to like learn how to do something, and you can't just make something out of wood. You have to go take a class and learn about all the things around doing it before you do it.
Mm.
And kept me from separate from actually being able to take those simple steps with my inspiration. I just kind of like let it squash a lot of my own inspiration.
To experience it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, oftentimes you see that with teaching and teachers, and we can never learn a lesson for someone else. So there has to be the space of experience for each person to go through the process.
Mm-hmm.
If it's too many rules, Master would say too many rules will kill the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
it's hard to walk into any church and it's hard to not see the rules staring you right in the face. They're all there. And in a sense, there's no judgment of that, because even for us, we have our own way. We have our own way of being here together and in our space together, of working together. These constitute our own traditions and ways of being. And so it's not about, it's not deluding ourselves to think that there will be no forms. The important part is that the form flows from the spirit. And we get in trouble when we think that the form is the purpose. And we cling to the forms. And boy, do we induce a lot of suffering when we start to cling to the forms. There is a proper order of operations. And it's very easy when our consciousness is on the outside to get the order wrong. Thanks, Box, for bringing that up. There was so much inspiration in the Jesus of Nazareth showings we've been having. That so many things he said.
Brother Zach, I was thinking about tradition and change, and in the context of sadhana, and one of the things that I feel like I inherited through the church was a tradition-based sadhana.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you've been helping me with is to not forget the spirit that's behind it all. And so that's something that I've been every day trying to remember that whatever mantra or technique, to remember that it's God, you know, like is the point. It's the point of it. But it's hard to have that, find the balance of it. I find sometimes I can slip away, and so I'm just trying to find a balance between some of the form of concentration and then with the flow of the spirit.
It's a great example of both the challenge and the importance of learning to give space to both aspects of our own life. And Bhima's point about sadhana is well taken. It's like if we don't have any practice that we're committed to, it's really going to be an uphill battle to getting ourselves uplifted and lifting up in the spine and taking ourselves into the higher planes. And yet, if we become rigid in our formula for how we're supposed to meditate, and it just becomes a to-do list that we're checking off things as we've done them, we find that we don't even remember God and why we're doing this in the first place. And that's even more painful, because sometimes a year or many years can pass before we realize that our practices haven't been with devotion, and they haven't had the purpose of loving God, which is first and foremost to seek God first. And of course we know this as our own teaching. So giving space for both of these to exist and allowing God to guide the techniques, giving space for the natural intelligence in ourself to take us into meditation and to help us be focused in God. I'm not here to say that it's easy, but it does become easier. And what it requires of us is that purity of intention and that consistent tradition of practicing. And make your own tradition that which works for you. And we should always have Kriya present in our meditation. We don't need to formulaically apply it and kill our spirit to thinking we have to do this or else we have failed. We need to simply get into that space with God and allow God to guide that Kriya practice and surrender even that to God with the intention of doing it. And in all these ways, we learn to walk a very dynamic balance between the outer and the inner and the form and the structure with God's living spirit and presence, which is guiding how we do the forms, how we take them on, and what their true purpose is. And as soon as we feel God's presence, as soon as we feel His calmness come upon us, let everything else fall away. Don't be trying to figure it out. Don't think about a thing. God is here and now. And the degree to which we accept that all the time is the degree to which perhaps all the forms are ready to fall away. But for all of us in this world, it's important that we know that form has its place and that forms will always be dissolving and being reborn as they are right and true for God's creation and for the good of all. And certainly that is the case for this ashram and this farm and this little Eden that exists here, that it will fall away when it's right and true for it to fall away. We need have no attachment to it. And yet it is in and of God that it exists today. And for those who come closer to the middle of it, they sincerely and with openness, they can always find the spirit as the guide, because that's all that it is. And there's nothing scarier to the ego than that spirit, so we'll also see a lot of people run. Last week the quote was repeated to me that someone had said, well, the ashram's presence at the Grange is heavy. And I thought, well, goodness. Farmers markets are heavy now. I don't know what we're talking about, but you know, we have to understand that for each person, as we step into serving our community in different ways, they are going to ultimately see themselves in us. And so we can't be attached or upset about these things. We just have to allow it to be what it is and wish for the best for everyone and allow spirit to be our guide. At any rate, I kind of got off track there, Bhima, but certainly it's all related.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate that thread too, of just how simple it makes it for in terms of our own choice and our only step is to come into the moment with God and allow Him to guide. What's are we supposed to? What direction is true and righteous for us to go in right now? Because I know from my own nature, learning to embrace a structure has been very helpful and needed, and still growing into that. But still, if it gets caught in the mind too much, then it stops being helpful.
That's right.
And I was really grateful, Zach, you gave meaning to the title of Fiddler on the Roof, which, you know, for all my proclaimed love of Broadway, never actually considered what the fiddler was doing up there. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Rome. Yeah. I had to ask myself, what the heck does the Fiddler on the Roof have to do with this theme of this movie? Yeah.
It's just that he's this calm center.
But Carl, you're right. And today we also, simultaneous to having what we could perceive as flaws of tradition or churchianity, we have the flaws of throwing out the baby with the bathwater and of people wanting to stand for nothing. And that's rampant nihilism. And it's an equal or even just as great problem in the world, is that, you know, because there are churches of Jesus that exist that aren't, you know, practicing Christianity maybe in the most holistic way. And we now throw out the Christ and we throw out openness to spirit. And of course, you and William and Bhima and I all experienced it at the last Grange meeting. And Bhima had brought his guitar. And we had simply had the thought that he could begin the meeting by offering a song with a prayer. And it was simple enough in our mind that if we can just get into that spirit together, everything can flow from the right place. And Bhima just holding the guitar set a couple people off in the room. And they basically said, it's completely unacceptable to bring prayer into this space. And I think for all of us, we felt the hollowness of that, and we felt the sadness in it, that the rejection of the spirit. And we all who hear Bhima play his guitar and the heart quality that is at the very center of it know where it comes from. It's not even Bhima. It's his relationship to God. And it was, in that way, the very rejection of the spirit and of the Christ spirit. And how fitting for the Easter season that we got to experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought of the reading that I read today and how none of that which I've experienced you get to avoid. You'll have to experience it too. And so you're in good company. These aren't things that we need to feel bad about ourselves.
Yeah.
These are confirmations that in fact we're on the right path in this world. And when we've become rejected by those of a worldly bent, that is actually something to rejoice in. That's a tribulation we can rejoice in. And it's hard for us to understand that if we're just an ego battling another ego. So we have to stay centered in God and say, okay, God, this is your choice for this situation. You have been rejected in me by this person, and I will accept that and move on. You got to show me what happens next. And I think that you guys did the next part last night, and just taking the next step and having it go relatively smoothly, and those who had rejected the spirit evaporated into the ether, as a satanic delusion often does. It can't hold on to something that's not real. And not to say it won't come back kicking and screaming later, but it's good to remember that that delusive influence doesn't have any substance. It's not grounded in the spirit. It only has power when we give it power.
I really appreciate your explanation about tradition and change and how it's what comes to me so strongly in your words is balance,
mm-hmm.
and having
mm-hmm.
that balance, and because with what's been going on with Mother and David's work and tradition versus change, and where, you know, trying to sort of understand exactly what God's doing with all of this,
mm-hmm.
and what really helped me a lot with your talk today is the balance of it,
mm-hmm.
and the need for both,
mm-hmm.
but yet that it has to remain balanced,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and the rigidity of, and like what you had said about the extremes of super extreme conservative and super extreme liberal,
mm-hmm.
and how that's just a disaster.
Yeah.
How difficult it makes it.
Yeah.
So
how they're actually the same. They're just on the opposite side throwing tomatoes at each other because they can't recognize sometimes it's good to be conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes traditions are worth preserving. Sometimes we need to have an awareness of that which is from before and needs to be honored. And also, for the conservative who says, let nothing new arise, my God, I pity the fool. You just have to root for him because you think you are setting yourself up for days, weeks, months, years of disappointment if your what relationship to life is hoping that nothing will ever change. Goodness. But you know, this is the traps we fall into, and it helps us to have these very extreme examples so that we can identify more modest ones in ourselves. That we can recognize when we've become very extreme in our own ideology and the need to be more open.
Mm-hmm.
And just like the rigidity part, it's like the problem with the form and the attachment to it is it closes us off to the potential for the spirit to have anything new for us. We think the only thing that mattered was what happened 40 years ago. And the truth is God is here now. God is alive now, and he wants us to wake up and live our life like that now. And if we think that tradition is all that matters, we have completely taken God out of the equation today, and that's a travesty. And that is what Master said when he said, I won't even recognize my work in 100 years. You guys will have crucified me. They will be destroyed. And it's because in the effort to preserve what Master did and said and was, we kill our own ability to realize Master here and now. But in our hearts, we stay open to the place for both of them. We don't allow ourselves to get too carried away in either extreme. And then we say, it's all good. It's all God.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for bringing that stuff up, Carl.
Yes.
I appreciate the litmus test.
Yeah,
because if you have sincerity, you could ask those two questions to yourself and see,
mm-hmm.
where am I uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
and then that could be a good starting place to,
mm-hmm.
for self-discovery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of self-honesty.
It does. Sincerity is essential to making progress on the path, and we have to be willing to face anywhere in ourselves where we're creating these kind of barriers towards our own growth.
Really appreciate what you said about Eden on the inside, but also when it's on the inside, God expresses as an outer Eden,
yeah.
And that's what is evident here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just such a unique and beautiful experience that when the Spirit of God, when you're seeking first that kingdom and that Eden on the inside,
mm-hmm.
then what has blossomed and grown and mm-hmm. continues to grow is an outer Eden. And I just wondered if there was anything more you might say about how the outer Eden, like living simply, independent of the world, and growing your own food and those traditions can lead also to finding God in that energy.
One of the things Master said at the very end of his talk was, and do not forget, this work needs you, and you need this work. That's an amazingly powerful thing, because he's tuning us into this timeless way of life that's been designed for all of humanity. And when the churches of today and the particular paths of religion that have been accepted as existing fall away in 1,000 years, 3,000 years, 100 years, 20 years, when these things on the outside fall away, there isn't what Master called immortal path to life. And I would say it's the path of Eden. And I think that to embark upon it is to actually embark on the purification that is necessary to create it. And I know that because I've lived it. And I didn't come from a place of thinking, I'm going to go do this. This is my path in life. It was because God woke me up to how he created this world and how I was supposed to live in it. And it's become a never-ending process of growing into it. And I feel very much that those who can see it have it in them. And those who can't see it don't have it in them yet. And that's Jesus saying that you shall be known by the fruit. Literally, the fruit is ripening before people's eyes, but some people see it and some people don't. And it's all about where we're at inside of ourselves, whether we can see it or not. We are drawn to that which we are. And so I feel how much that this direction, it requires God, and it also gives us our direct avenue of realizing God, not as an abstraction, not as creating some separate idea of church and state, but as an integrated life that is filled with God's creation, and that we are a steward and we are a humble channel for it all to exist and to live in harmony together. And so when that harmony does manifest on the outside and through our own sight and how we relate and live with life, it's been cultivated on the inside for it to even be there. So in that way, I think when we have integrity, we can't separate the things on the outside from the things on the inside. We don't even want to. We realize that we want our life to look like God's life. We want our life to be full of nature and abundant in God's creation. We don't want to hide from this world and this life. We realize God is all of it, and our job is to love all of it. And I think that that's an amazing, liberating direction for us. It is the true tradition of man. And so for all the people that preach tradition, I often wonder, how are you living your own life? Are you living it in the timeless tradition? Or have you embraced these temporary, fleeting traditions of Wall Street, of God knows what has been created by man in the last few decades? You know, I think that if we really believe in tradition, we'll go to the heart of tradition, to the timeless, immortal way of life. And I think it's amazing because Master spoke to these things so directly, but he said it was God that showed him. It's not that we love Master, so we do this. We do love Master, but it's that we realize God's vision in life. And so we do this because it's timeless and it's true. It's not true because Master said it. Master said it because it's true. But also Master says true things. So I think that the inside and the outside game we will always be playing. But as we wake up on the inside, we see the truth on the outside. And we know what's true and what's not. And I think for all of us, we can rejoice that we have this relationship where we can see life on the outside. I've often shared with you, one of my favorite things to do is to, when I go on drives, is to look at homesteads. Mm-hmm. It's like going to my art museum. Like, I go to art museums sometimes, and I had a good experience at one recently because I met a young man who was sent by God and it was a great experience. But I'm looking at the art and I'm thinking, it's alright. Like, wouldn't put that on my wall, but it's okay. But if we drive around and we think of life as the art museum, one of the funnest things to observe is how do people interact with the life that they're living around them? And I look at their houses and how they've built them. I look at their yards and I think of Doug's gate, their gates. The quality of all of the things that they're doing in the world around them. And that is Eden. Because it's not separating your own life from your spiritual path. It's not separating how you live from your spiritual path. Your bedroom, your bathroom. I mean, Peony worked on ours yesterday and it needed some help. I needed some help. That's my spiritual life too. And I think that when we're willing to integrate these things, the outside and the inside, the Eden of God just merges into oneness. And then we go around and we're amazed sometimes at the Edens that we will come across. It's not to say, if we say that this is like an Eden, it's not to say it's the only one. Eden exists wherever somebody has that kind of harmony and relationship to life. Sometimes it's purely in vibration alone. But often we find it manifests also in the forms that take shape from that vibration. And I think that we are open to seeing miracles, wonderful things. The most inspiring places I have ever been were so full of the Spirit on the inside, and they also manifested that Spirit on the outside. And I think of St. John of the Cross's convent in Segovia. And I've never seen a place is a higher bar than our own still. It's a place that I still strive for. Through the level of integration that they had, 30 young monks living together and farming together and creating natural food forests and churches that were caves in the hillside and little chapels spread around and meditation benches dispersed amidst the orchards. Mm-hmm. It was pretty tremendous. My jaw was on the ground and I loved every minute of it. And that was Eden that came from within them. And we went into their church and there was Mount Carmel and there was the river of life going up the top of Mount Carmel. And I thought, they know Eden in themselves. And here it is on the outside. It's a wonderful thing when we can experience that. And that's what God wants for this life and creation. He wants His truth to be made whole in the spirit of our inner understanding and in the truth of how we live our life. And I think that that is the highest way to relate to this ashram and what we're doing together. Is it's making true God's truth in on the outside. So thank you for asking that, Rebecca. I really can get carried away when I go in that direction. There's so much joy. So many wonderful Edens in this world. And so many kind of anti-Edens. The anti-Edens are there to wake us up to Eden. And when we see an anti-Eden, boy, does it make me want to go get my hands back in that mulched earth and plant a tree and go say hi to Pesto, whatever it is, you know. I think one of the things that we benefited from for years was being up here and aspiring to create this Eden through Master's grace, through God's will. And also having to constantly be taken out of it back into the consciousness of tradition and of rigidity and of the world. And I don't feel like I was a victim to it at all. I felt like it was so helpful and it helped me become more clear every time. And I just remember so many times I would get home really late at night after being down there all day and serving and doing things that I was like, what am I doing? And I would get back to the farm and I'd look up and those stars would never be brighter. Or the moon would never have more of prana flowing towards me. And it was because I went out there into anti-Eden that I could come back here and feel it with fresh eyes. And I always have felt how living in all these cities for so long before finding my path, when I finally got back to 8,400 feet in the Sierra, and I went up to my mountain lookout and looked out, it was like all of my years of being in the confusion of the world fell away in one moment, and I was primed for it. It's like I was so open and receptive to life again, because I had been living in death. And it really made it possible for me to see God in his creation, because I had been living in all kinds of things that were born out of delusion. So I was grateful. I'm grateful for all of them. Sometimes we just need to see the ugly to choose the beauty.
As I listen, I find myself coming up with an inner hanging point, and it's simply the word God. And I realize that a lot of people get stuck there. They reject just the concept, whatever that means, and how much baggage the world has around that word.
Yeah.
And for me, it's okay. I like it. Sometimes I internally brace, and then I look for what is a felt experience of God, rather than getting caught in a word.
Mm-hmm.
What is a felt experience?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's more important. And so to have other people say, well, what word would you choose? You know, sometimes it's just universe, it's vibration, it's alignment with the highest.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it really is it's an interesting thing to watch what goes on internally for me.
Mm-hmm.
In that way. And how would I adapt my vision of life, my feeling of life, to someone else who might, like if the people at the Grange, you know, somebody mentions God, everybody bristles, you know.
We didn't even have to use the G word.
Right.
They just, it was the P word.
Yeah.
That was upsetting.
Yeah.
The which word?
Prayer.
Prayer. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But you know, Doug, I would just say that the ego is very threatened by the idea of an authority that's greater than itself. But the soul doesn't sweat it anymore. And doesn't, you know, I think of like a box that says natural ingredients. And the word natural is actually being used to define unnatural ingredients. And it's being used in reverse. And God has been abused in that way as a word.
Mm-hmm.
And we have what Master called churchianity become a problem, where religion is being used for the means of men. And yet, if we throw out the baby with the bathwater, we close ourselves off to the potential of God.
Yeah.
That is so much greater.
Yeah.
Than what anybody's ego can dream up.
Yeah.
Or be offended by. And so I think the process you're expressing is a very universal one.
Mm-hmm.
And a very valuable one that we all go through, of universalizing our own definition. You know, I won't give away the word nature, because they use natural to mean artificial. Nature still means God to me.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, if we describe ourselves as a natural farm, some people have said, well, how can you be a natural farm? Cheez-Its say natural ingredients on them. And I said, well, that's true, but I'm not going to let them have the word nature. And just like the word God, when we're ready to grow into the greater reality of the universe, of the wholeness of life, God's the word he gave us, and it falls away.
I find it very interesting, just the whole territory of language. And, you know, how many different languages are there on the planet? How many, how it takes us up into our head and out of our heart so easily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so,
mm-hmm.
And the practice of just living in my heart has become much more essential than
Amen. Yeah, in a lot of ways, language kind of represents the tradition. And so it kind of becomes fixed and dogmatic in how we relate to it. And that's how you see a lot of people in the West, like ourselves, who maybe felt a little burned by Christianity or the ideals of evangelicalism or the Catholic Church or whatever. And so then our own openness to spirit maybe came through like India. Because we don't have the baggage to the word Ram.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, okay, well, they're saying Sri Ram, Jai Ram. Like, what does that mean? Like, they seem to believe in it, and I don't have any baggage with them, and they seem happy, so I'll try that. And then, you know, before you know it, you're saying Ram as God.
Mm.
And then before you know it, like an Indian's before you, and they're using the word God. And you think, wow, maybe God's okay. Maybe it was the confusion of men that was the problem, and it was never God.
Exactly. When you talked about the Grange and the opposition of prayer, I thought about two things. One, I thought about our whole separation of church and state, which says you can't have prayer because this sex prayer is different than this one, and you know. And then I also thought about the Crusades. Where's the spirit? All paths lead to the same, you know, to the same vows. Where was the spirit in that? And then I think of today's Christian nationalists. What an oxymoron. So that's what I was thinking, was that these people are afraid of spirit.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And they don't believe in one spirit, that, you know, one path.
Yeah, that's right.
All paths are.
That's right.
The same.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I think of the Grange, there's like this rising tide of kind of worldly, secular consciousness just wanting to increase. And it's like, oh, we're just kind of, the Grange is transforming into a country club,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of like hosting events
mm-hmm.
that really don't have any ties to the spirit,
mm-hmm.
and which is pretty painful. But it's like so disconnected from the founding principles.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realize I can't have any attachment to, and after the last meeting, I was like, I definitely can't force anything. But serving, like, I can't remember how you phrased it the other day, but just serving in secret is really the only way that I could see, and to just stand and at my unglorified post as secretary is,
that's right,
which is the most mundane thing I could think of. I used to joke that I'm like, ah, I'm done with the school, I don't have to be a pen pusher anymore. And as always, Divine Mother called my bluff. Now I'm the secretary of the Grange, whatever that means. But definitely remarkable. But I see what's there to be done. And I just have to do it with God.
Yeah.
And just have to be, as all of us here are just a friend to all, to stand up for the truth as I see it, and then just let go.
What William's referencing to, the tradition of the Grange, which inspired so many of us, was the ideal of its members secretly serving the Christ in everyone. So not promoting religion or trying to have an outwardly religious mission, and yet very clearly amongst themselves being able to identify their role together as serving the Christ spirit that lives in everyone. But, you know, where we're at today and what we experienced was that even that thought is still very threatening amongst the members of the Grange. And that's a tradition that they would reject outright. That the Bible has any place at the Grange is completely unacceptable. And yet, it is the tradition of the Grange that the Bible be on the table for the meeting. And so now we're faced on the kind of other end of a pendulum where, like, well, here we are believing in tradition, and here it is being rejected by the change that of the sectarian world right now. And, you know, I think what's apparent is that our priority needs to be secretly serving the members of the Grange now. They are not able to do it consciously. We're not able to sit in this room together and agree in the existence of a universal intelligence that's guiding our life for the better. So we can't agree to that. Mm-hmm. So now I have to do it in secret. And that's okay. You know, it's like we basically just are stepping one step back from where we thought we might be, which was like, let's play a song. Word God, not even necessary. Let's play a song.
Yeah.
And it's like, we will not have songs. And it's like, oh my gosh. Like, but you know, we're an ashram, so people understand that we're spiritual. We're wearing our ashram shirts. That's threatening to a sectarian mind that doesn't stand for much except chasing what it wants. I get it. And, you know, none of us are there to judge anyone. So ultimately, we surrender this like we do everything else, and we say, okay, like, is there any point of common ground that we can find? Is there anything that, is there any reason we can identify that we're all at this table that feels good? And I think we find that's even very difficult. If the motivations of some are selfish, then it gets harder and harder to identify a point of commonality. But there's one in there, and that's the holy thread that we look for. And we do our best to uphold righteousness in all things and do it just. Do our best, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think cooperation is a good one to get behind. When you think of the farms and the farm co-ops, and how unifying that idea still works.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, cooperative. The cooperative spirit is really essential. I think that's probably what we were going for. It's just like, we could all just feel like we're in this together for a song, like everything would be great and work. But yeah, I think even that is a, can be a high bar to the state of the world. And yeah, people would very much promote non-cooperation with Christianity or Buddhism or whatever they're up, whatever they're opposed to. Non-cooperation is a very real attitude. Yeah, Doug, I think what you're tuned into are all, is also, all of it's very true, that just trying to be as most, the universal as we can with everyone, and to help in whatever avenues God provides for us, that's really all we're interested in. We know that. We just do our best. Sometimes it's messy.
Yeah, I find that words are really important to me, and a constant frustration for me. I mean, it's the poet in me, and the lyricist in me that's constantly looking for that right kernel to express something, you know. And so I'm not quite sure where I was going with that, but just that, I don't know, it matters.
Yeah, well, Jesus's words were very strong when he was confronted about the nature of truth versus delusion. He didn't temper himself and the truth for the comfort of someone else's ego. And so at certain times, we just have to be willing to say the truth, even if it's upsetting to someone else. But whenever possible, we turn the other cheek. It's up for God to let us know when each circumstance is appropriate. But it's nice to think we could navigate everything comfortably with every perfect word. But sometimes the perfect word is just to say, "You, that's crazy," and just call it what it is. If, especially if it's arrived at attacking the spirit, you know, I think we just have to say that's not okay, and we need to be able to say that this doesn't feel good now. This kind of negativity doesn't feel good, and that's also very upsetting to someone who's entitled to their words. So it's just, you know, we all have to do our best. Sri Yukteswar would say, we need to look past the confused verbiage of men to see what their true inner meaning is in anything that's being expressed. And so that's our responsibility to each other. Is if I use the God word, you know I mean universal intelligence. If I use Christ, that's the universal intelligence that lives in you. But if we relate to that only religiously, we're offended by the word Christ. Mm-hmm. And what can we really do? You can't please everyone by choosing the perfect word all the time.
Even love is a tricky word.
We've been navigating that one. What love is and what's love's purpose. There's different forms of love. That's very real. There's tough love. Well, thank you guys for the wonderful conversation. Feels timely and where we're at right now.
Yeah.
Let's just take our opportunity to get into that universal spirit and allow God to place in our hearts and minds all those we want to pray for this morning. Seeing all these souls in God's peace. In God's joy. Let's pray together, Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Thou art omnipresent.
Thou art omnipresent.
Thou art in all your children.
Thou art in all your children.
Manifest your loving presence.
Manifest your loving presence.
In these bodies, minds, and souls.
In these bodies, minds, and souls.
Peace.
Peace.
Bless.
Bless.
Amen.